exciting.
Welcome, everybody, to another week of PDGA Radio. I'm Jennifer Allen, along with Grant Zellner.
And more importantly than that, we've got a very special guest for you today. A long conversation with, the disc golf guy. Terry Miller has taken time out of his incredibly busy schedule to spend just a few minutes, well, let's make that more than an hour, with Jennifer and I talking about all of the things, not only that he does or has done in the world of disc golf, but also offering some really great nuggets of advice for you. Whether you want to get into directing tournaments, whether you want to get into something to do with disc golf media, or maybe you just want to appreciate this game on a deeper level. Let's get into it. It's Terry Miller on PDGA Radio.
Terry always looks good.
Welcoming in the good-looking Terry Miller, the disc golf guy, into the PDGA Radio studio here. And there's no off-season. We all know that at this point. But Terry, you sort of epitomize that. But we've got to go back to the beginning for so many of our listeners who think they know who Terry Miller, the disc golf guy, is because of one thing that they know that you do. It might be they know you because of DGN. They know you as a commentator or something like that. And the fact of the matter is they don't know what they don't know. So first of all, Terry Miller, welcome. And thank you for taking a few moments out of your incredibly busy schedule to join us today.
Well, thank you guys so much. Great to be here. Being on the other side occasionally of the interview stand, so to speak, is right. Always a pleasure and always an honor. So thank you guys.
We figure we just ask you to interview yourself, and Jennifer and I'll just take this one off. We'll mute our microphones. So what's the first thing you want to ask yourself? No, I'm kidding. I'm totally kidding.
Because Terry is probably the first person to ever really interview me. And he knows I hated it. Hated being interviewed. So it's kind of funny for me to be able to do this. So I'm excited to have you as a guest.
Maybe that's the launch pad, Jen. When was that?
Way back. I don't know. 10 years ago, probably.
I would go ahead and guess around 2010. 2012, 2013, somewhere in that neighborhood. Probably Jen was one of the first times that we talked. And I'll just quickly say, you, like everyone, there is a hesitation. Not everybody loves to talk or be interviewed. And now look at how comfortable
so many people.
Look at you now. look at Owen Scoggins, who was terrified to talk to me. And now you can't get her to shut up because she's always entertaining us.
She's great. Yes. Yeah. She's a mess.
So what people don't know, Terry, is you're talking about 10 years ago, 12 years ago, something like that, interviewing Jennifer. But you had been at it for many years, even before that. And that's just one of the things. I'm having such a hard time knowing where to start with you. So let's do this. Let's go back. Let's go back to your beginning in disc golf, just at least briefly, because people don't know as much of a player as you are in terms of how long you've been playing the game at a competitive level as both an amateur and then as a pro. They don't know that I looked it up. Your membership as part of the PDGA goes back to 1995.
Dang.
Yeah. Surprisingly, even a little bit before Jen, we're of similar age range.
Very close.
And I was introduced to it in sometime around seventh or eighth grade. Played a little bit, and by the time I was in high school, I was then already helping organizing me and all my buddies to go play in tournaments. Played my first amateur world championships in 96, so hence I picked up my number sometime in 95,
right.
And played a handful of AM Worlds championships, which were a much smaller ordeal at the time, and then I played in 16 consecutive Pro Worlds from 2000 to 2015. And so when it was all said and done, I played 20 years of world championships in a row And eventually at some point I started working more of them and running. I ran a Worlds in 2007. So being around that scene for a long time, and as I went to college, I learned that I really enjoyed running tournaments. I enjoyed playing in them for sure. I was playing 25, 30, 35 weekends a year. But then I also realized that I enjoyed hosting events and putting a club together. And then I found out about tournament directing, along with designing courses, working with schools, youth groups, church camps, instruction of any kind that I could. And so it just kind of continued to blossom into about 20 different avenues of mm-hmm. disc golf promoting when it was all said and done.
Let's stay in that avenue then for a little while in terms of the event running. And in your case, the tremendous exposure that you got to different types of events because of having played, and then sort of parlaying that into what you learned for yourself, how to run a great event. Can you tell us in your own experience what makes great events?
Well, we've definitely had an evolution. Jen can speak to this as well as anyone. Is back in 1998 or 99, I was running my first ever sanctioned event, and I was sending an email to everyone and telling them to click on this thing so that they could prepay, because pre-registration was normal. Yeah,
no, it wasn't normal. Sign up the morning of.
Exactly. And that frustrated me, because that was a log jam always. So I always pushed so hard for pre-registration, and I was sending them this link to this email where they got $5 if they were to go use this system, and I got a $5 bonus as well. That little thing was called PayPal. Like, I literally was sending invites for people to use PayPal, to now look where PayPal is today, 20 some years later. And then at one point, fast forward a few years from that, I ultimately started my own online registration service that ran events like the Memorial and Ledgestone for a couple of years for the registration service. And then this little thing called Disc Golf Scene with a much better looking, smarter man came along and ultimately put me out of business. But pre-registration was very serious to me, because that's what helped make an event better, is to have all of those things ahead of time. So I pushed so hard. I mean, I made enemies because of my pre-registration policies, and I don't regret it at all. And now, you know, now events are selling out in 4 minutes, and you know, I kind of missed my time. But running events early, you know, in the 90s, events were very different. I would play in an amateur event and win $62 of funny money, and they would actually sometimes let you go pay for the next amateur event with that funny money. I mean, life was totally different, right? And I was taking, and if I was using the funny money, I was going home with, you know, 19 discs, because discs were $7 a piece, and all there was DX plastic. So
It was,
you were getting 3 for $20 often from your tournament director. And so, you know, just trying to take a little bit of the bigger events that I went to, whether it was the Worlds or a few of the super tours or A tiers as they came along, that's what you would kind of learn from. And one of the best phrases I ever got from my mentors and people that really helped me, I remember them saying, if you run an event and you don't lose any money, you somehow break even as a tournament director, then you ran a damn good event. And that is kind of scary to think about in this day and age. And that's where volunteerism and grassroots have gotten us. But clearly, we're way past that with $100,000, $300,000 budgets and purses. It's been a very, very enlightening, interesting experience over the last 20 some years.
Terry, what's your thoughts on TDs getting paid?
Way overdue. And of course, I'm very, biased in that. I think run 250 or so PDGA events and another 200 unsanctioned events in my life. So people hated it. People to this day sometimes really cringe or you know, fight against anyone making a few dollars, what was a few dollars if you did come out ahead. Why not? I mean, the effort it takes to put in a tournament, and if you're putting on a good event and people continue to come and you're meeting all the requirements and probably exceeding them, you should also get paid for those efforts. And some old school, you know, listeners may, you know, not like that, but these are full-time jobs for some people.
People don't realize the countless hours, months and months it takes to put on even a small event, let alone a huge event. So I think maybe even a flip side of that, the old school golfers do understand probably way more than the newer ones, because we've seen it. We've seen how many TDs get yelled at some point. You know, you never satisfy everyone at the course. So then there's, you know, just paying for your stress of doing it and trying to make everyone happy. But it is definitely a thankless job, I think, sometimes. So I agree to that. I think they should get paid.
You see a lot of TDs just get burned out. They yeah. end up disappearing right, sure. because, like you said, if it's thankless, even if you are making money, it might not mm-hmm. be worth it. You know, sometimes right. the scrutiny you go through.
Yeah.
How many events a year now are you still running, Terry?
I am now down to just a handful. And there's a few years ago, I had to miss out on my own tournament, the Cold Turkey that comes up right after Thanksgiving, because I had an once in a lifetime opportunity to go to Australia. And I was like, well, I can't cancel the tournament. It's sold out. But, you know, I had other people fill in for me. I'm down to about two or three events per year, along with a little bit of help, which is, you know, quite a step back from the six or so sanctioned and the six or so unsanctioned events a year. So from 12 to 15 down to about two or three. I'm out of weekends, but now I want to start running weekday flex starts because it services people like me, and maybe I'll be able right. to get out and play in a few.
If somebody wanted to get into, you know, we've talked about how tournament directors in years past maybe have worked very, very hard and then just sort of either burnt out or just moved on to something else. Now we need more events. I mean, to your point a few minutes ago, every event, it seems like they're selling out in sometimes a matter of minutes. So we need more event runners to come up with more reasons to have events, more places to have events. What would you say to encourage tournament directors fledgling tournament directors to get into it? Maybe someone that's never directed and is maybe intimidated by the thought. I mean, what tips can you give somebody?
Well, for starters, thanks to the PDGA. Thanks to others like UDisc and Disc Golf Scene and just the overall process of so many different tools and assets that are available. I mean, I know it's been said that the PDGA hopes somebody could run a B tier from their phone, and we've arrived. You can run a B tier essentially from your phone. I don't recommend it. There's easier ways to do it, but if you had to, right. you can. And that is a hat off and a testament and nothing but kudos to everyone at the PDGA staff. You know, I remember getting a TD packet in the mail that was like, here's literally, you know, 30 yeah, pieces of paper mm-hmm. and here's how you run a tournament. And now you're doing everything online within minutes. So, first thing is obviously you got to jump in, but second of all, as you're jumping in or thinking about it, just go help out at a tournament or two. Stand behind the scenes, whether you're observing or you're actively involved. Just watch a couple of other tournament directors, a couple of people that you know put on good events that are efficient, that you know, seem to do things right. Go ask if you can help them. Rarely will they say no. And even if they say, no, I'm good on help, they'll let you quietly observe, assuming you don't get in their way. Do that. Because you will see, you'll hear some of the questions. You'll see when somebody comes up and walks up to you and is leaning on the piece of paper that says tee off at 2 p.m. They're leaning on it saying, what time's tee off? And they're like getting angry with you as they're literally leaning on the piece of paper. You'll have those experiences. And to be fair, we all know customer service is a big part of being a TD. And mm-hmm. you have to realize if you're not customer service, if you don't have the patience, sometimes for stupid things, if you don't have that patience, be the support system to somebody who does.
Right.
And I think TDing is not for everyone. It truly is not. You may think it is, but you have to have a certain skill set, and maybe you are. There's so many good supporting roles that are directly behind the TD as well. Sometimes a TD is just literally a talking head. And they're just, right. you know, able to speak when they have a team of two or four or nine people behind them doing all the really mm-hmm. hard work. So find, you know your role or kind of find where you're comfortable. But I think those are some of the things. And then just take notes. What did you like about a tournament? Did you like that they provided lunch? Did you like how they did the players meeting? Did you like that there was no play? There was a small players pack and a huge payout? Or did you like that everyone got a huge players pack and there was no payout? You know, take note of trophies. Trophies are, I think trophies, if there's ever going to be anything that drives me out of TDing, it's the trophy hassle. And now we've got so many people scrutinizing every single trophy with its quality. I think your trophy should match the scale of the event. Obviously, or the bigger the event, the better the trophy.
That think that they don't even want it, that trophies are a waste of time. There's those players that's wasted money spent.
Yeah. So you need to really decide, because the worst thing in the world, and this goes back to point A of, you know, trying to break even. Well, buying trophies for people that didn't pre-register or don't sign up in time, or trophies that go wasted. There's no worse feeling than essentially tossing a trophy away because you ended up not even having that division, or, you know, you didn't have three people in the division. So that's why, again, this goes back to pre-reg, and there's so many ways we could kind of, you know, circle this, but those are all some of the ways that I would say, and you got to jump into it. I mean, there's like kids, almost literally kids out there running events now because technology and a little bit of asking will go a long way. So the tools and the resources by the PDGA couldn't be easier. And as much as I am a huge supporter of the PDGA, maybe run an unsanctioned event that has slightly lesser expectations.
Stress.
Yeah, yeah. Stress, status, expectations. Run one or two of those and then say, oh, okay, yeah, I'm ready to take this to the next level.
Right. A few leagues, a few minis.
Sure. Bingo.
So, Terry, you missed your own tournament because Australia. Why are you not joining us this year?
Apparently, I got iced out of somebody snuck in and grabbed. It sounds like there was a deal going on with some with the production companies. I did talk to them, and obviously all good. I hope everyone that goes over there enjoys it. It was a opportunity of a lifetime that I had. I made lifelong friends, but I'm not going to Australia or New Zealand this year. But hopefully it sounds like it's in the works for me to get back there at some point.
It's the people over there, like you said, are lifelong friends. Like once you go, it's incredible. I will be shocked if I can get my daughter to come home. They've been in New Zealand, I think, a week and a half now with Simon. And so, it's pretty incredible over there.
Yeah. The one of the few times I've had to miss my own tournament to go do something else. And that was, I don't regret that one at all.
Totally worth it. Well, before we completely leave behind the topic of directing events, Terry, people that don't know about your history when you're not in front of the camera that goes back, they're also not going to know about the work that you did early on, I think, in women's disc golf and in promoting women's events or whether they were women's only events or getting more women out to existing events. Through that sort of 2000s to the aughts, I guess, era. And people also might not know, so we'll share with them, you're from the Midwest, based in the Midwest. So a lot of your work has been in that hotbed of disc golf activity through that era. Can you shine some light a little bit on those early days and on promoting and getting women's disc golf really kind of up and running and, you know, where things are now going, with that?
Yeah. I think back to, you know, for me 20 ish years ago, we were in the same boat that we were in 10 years ago and in 30 years ago, you know, all this general history of this 7% roughly or 7 to 9% participation coming from our women in the sport. And I'll never forget being at a conference, I guess more of a committee among a bunch of us in Wisconsin, our promoters and TDs. And for hours, we debated all these different ways to entice more women to play, to encourage them to do all these different things. And then finally, someone raised their hand like, we've been talking about this for like 2 hours and we're still 30 guys sitting in a room trying to figure out how to get more women to come to events. And I'm like, that was maybe part of the problem right there.
Wow.
And it's been tough. And clearly we're starting to see a shift finally, you know, in the last few years, especially at our professional level in terms of being a touring professional. But we've had this upward battle forever of participation. And I'm not a psychologist, so I still haven't figured out women ever. I don't think I ever will.
You never will. I never will.
You and me both, brother.
You know, it's been tough because, you know, I could ask Jen, you know, what are her top five priorities in disc golf, and then ask her daughter, and then ask, you know, someone who just started the game, and everyone has these different priorities, and trying to appease and entice really more women to play has been just that, an upward battle. And I continue to arrive at, I think women need to bring out more women. I think, you know, men have plenty of their strengths and plenty of their weaknesses and faults. And I think the best way ultimately is for women to bring out more women. So one thing I used to do, this was very early on, is I had an email alias. It was like Women at Lifetime Disc Sports, which is my company. And it was a collection of every woman in the 4 or 5 state area. And at one point, they could then just send to that email and it would say, hey, we're going to try and make a concerted effort to get 20 women to this event. Or, hey, we're thinking about going to this event. Who else is thinking about it? So they were kind of self, you know, filling divisions, or at least kind of doing some of that planning, because as Jen will tell you, there's nothing more frustrating than to go to an event and then be like, be excited about it. Great course, great payout, great tournament. And then there's 3 women, you know, or there's 6 women. Or one.
One back in the day. And even now you still see that.
You do.
You know, I won my tournament. Granted, I was the only one, you know, and that's hard. It's hard to, even when you play well, to be proud of yourself when you didn't beat anyone.
Yeah.
And not like fulfilling. That's what it's about, but still.
Well, yeah. And you know, and I recognize women want all the, you know, similar things that men want at an event in terms of playing with other women, playing with, you know, people, like-minded conversations and experiences and whatnot. So I did everything I could. There was at one point for a couple of years, I ran every single division in women's division at little or no cost. It might've been $10 or it was free for most divisions for free. I wanted to
and
eliminate.
And gave them a payout.
Yeah. And then still pay them out as if they paid a full entry fee. Yeah. And I wanted to eliminate that reasoning of saying, well, I don't have the money. I don't want to spend the money. I made it free.
Yeah.
That didn't increase participation.
It didn't work.
It didn't work. You know, I tried every single thing we heard about trying, and it still didn't seem to increase the numbers. And that's when I gently threw my hands up and was like, I don't know, women, you need to bring out other women, because what we're trying isn't working. So
I agree,
those are some
that.
Of the things, though. I think communication, having women know that other women are going to go to an event, and it's like, oh, hey, like, let's all plan on that. And then I didn't run them until Women's Global came along in like 2012 or 2014, but you know, running and participating in a Women's Global or any women's only event, I think is absolutely huge. And I wish I would have thought more of that, you know, even 15 years ago, but that's definitely, I think, a huge solution right now.
Women's only events?
Women's only events, I think, just fosters that atmosphere and that experience. And it lets everyone's guard down a little bit. I think it's more inviting. I mean, Jen can correct me if I'm wrong, but there's a different vibe. I've been to plenty of women's only events to support or cover them. And there's definitely a different vibe, and it's so much more welcoming and inviting. And I love it.
I agree completely. And Terry's on his way out here to Phoenix for our Phoenix Ladies Open, which he has filmed for how many years now? A lot.
Probably, yeah, 6 out of the last 7 or 7 out of the last 8 or so. Yeah.
Yeah. But you can definitely feel it, just kind of motivates and lights a fire, I think, to be involved, whether that be a player, hopefully, or just being out to watch more golf. It is a totally different atmosphere. You feel like you're part of it versus, you know, gosh, I don't know how many years I played where there would be just maybe a couple in all divisions at a tournament, women, you know, you were just one of a few, maybe a handful at the entire tournament. So I think when you do get at the women's only events, and that's the only people at the course besides volunteers, you know, are all women. And so it is empowering and definitely, I would say, motivational to play more and to be more involved.
Well, yeah, I feel like you women then are the focus of the event. They're not just another participant. They're the actual mm-hmm. focus of the event. And if that's what it's going to take to encourage more women and foster those relationships and those feelings, then I say we need to keep at it.
Yeah, I agree. I've had tournament directors for years or back in the days, like with you, when we were really trying to get more women involved, they would call me and ask, you know, what can we do? What can we do? Is it the players pack? Is, you know, is it the entry fees, like you mentioned? And I would usually respond with, it's just us, you know, like, because it is. And whether that be, you know, that we needed to do housework over the weekend, or, you know, our kids, we didn't have babysitters. And that was always a thing, you know, because a lot of these women were mothers, you know, back then. It wasn't like a younger crowd female player. It was more a little bit older. And so a lot of them had kids. And so, you know, finding daycare was always an issue. But a lot of it was just the fact that we didn't put it first. You know, the men were like, oh, I had 50 reports to do, and I had the yard to mow. I had all this stuff to do, but they would choose golf and put everything else, you know, kind of on the back burner, where women didn't prioritize it as our main concern and priority to be there. So I think we're finally getting there. But it definitely takes more women, not only encouraging, but just for us seeing that there's more women playing, that, you know, it is okay that we put that first and we get out there and have fun.
Yeah. And if that's your long-winded way of saying that women are better than men, you're right. I mean, let's face it, the men get to disregard things, and it ultimately it falls on the wife or the mother and the women. It
never
does.
That never came out.
You're
but
right,
I feel
though,
like
because
we
the
did
default,
prioritize that more. Yes, it seemed like I saw that right. for a long time. And like I said, it was kind of more maybe like the motherly thing. But yeah, daycare was always something that always popped up. You always heard that, not as an excuse. I mean, children are clearly not an excuse, but it was just an issue. Like, we didn't want to.
I would
you know.
Have played except for mm-hmm. that.
And there was, you know, definitely several people who tried to open up a daycare or have, you know, someone volunteer to watch all the kids or whatever. But even that's hard, you know, leaving your children with strangers. So. But yeah, we're getting there. I think in the next 5 years, we'll really see a huge difference on participation.
And on that point, you know, the FPO and the FA1 players of tomorrow are the junior players of today. And so, you know, on the same token, you were talking about how certain things that seem like they would be incentive really weren't. They didn't work as incentives to get more women to play. Similarly, what's it take to get more juniors, both women and or both boys and girls? What does it take to get more and more juniors playing? Because I don't know what it's like in your neck of the woods, Terry or Jennifer out in Phoenix, but you know, here in my part of the country, you kind of have similar problems in terms of getting full fields of juniors. You have a lot of situations where if you want to take your kiddo out to an event, they get out to the event and then they get to play against nobody.
Yeah.
And you have that kind of thing happening. So are the solutions sort of similar? Are there a few differences in the solutions?
Yeah, I feel I played with a gentleman just yesterday. We found out our daughters are almost the exact same age, one of which his daughters does love to play, the other one not as much. And he had that exact same experience. They'd go to tournaments. She'd be the only one or one of only a few juniors. And then he did kind of like we were saying, he just then started running juniors only tournaments and does everything he can to get more juniors to play. And then we had this same conversation about, well, at the end of the day, the dad in this case needs to not go play their tournament if that means their junior kid is going to play, because you got to get them there. You're going to help them out and everything else, depending on the age. So yeah, I think it comes down to a commitment from and sacrifice or compromise mm-hmm. from the parent often the dad in this case, to say, yeah, I'm going to take little Timmy or Joey or Ann to this event. And, you know, that means I'm giving up my day of playing because I'm going to go do this as well. Or like he did, just host his own series. And you have to be okay with the idea that some of your events are going to get 20 kids that may or may not grow into 40 or 60 or 90. But you have to be okay with you're going to get 20 or 30. And you have to just keep pushing forward, hoping that it grows. And even if it doesn't, all you can do is make the experience for those 20 that are there the greatest day of their year, right? The best event they played all year. I think that's what you have to do. That takes a lot of sacrifice and commitment by a lot of people to do it. But I think that's what's needed.
I agree completely. And it was the same thing even back in the day, Grant in Oklahoma. My kids love to play. And two of three are really good golfers. But they never play, you know, my daughter played every women's global event until this last one. That was like her main tournament. She played, every 2 years. There was a couple local events that they would play to get, and there was, you know, maybe two or three that would come out as well. And so, you know, it is sad. There's a lot of kids who do love the game, but it is hard. And I know as a parent, until now my son is 17, I did not want to put him in with intermediate or rec or these grown men, you know, to play an event. I didn't want, you know, for many reasons. There's a lot of different reasons that I didn't want them playing with grown men, but or the women, you know, with my daughter. But It's we're getting there, I think, too. You know, you look at junior worlds, how many, oh my gosh, it filled in how many seconds for the juniors. So I think we're getting there. We're seeing it in so many more school systems. And then just the tournaments that I've been going around, like Utah has a lot of great kids. There's several young kids here in Phoenix. California has, you know, a lot. Is Andy Parkinson puts on a huge juniors event every single year. So I think we're going to get there, but I do feel it is very similar to our growth in women and the problems and the same issues that we've had with them.
Hey, Terry, when it comes to drumming up support for these events, junior events, women's events, or just events in general, in your experience, what works in terms of getting outside support? I'm talking about whole sponsors or even bigger sponsors of the event, or just people to donate something in kind to help put an event on or to help get the word out. Or, you know, you talked a minute ago about making sure an event is, even if it's a smaller event, making sure it's the best day of the year for those players. What in your experience has worked for you in terms of getting other forms of support?
Yeah, I think, well, essentially, first, it's about covering those bases, right? It's making sure there's bathrooms, you know, or that the bathrooms aren't locked. And I'll admit, being a guy, it was easy for me to overlook for quite a few years until you really realize, hey, we've got junior boys, junior girls, and women here. So let's make sure that they have appropriate bathroom facilities. I think it's a little bit easier of a sell, honestly, to go to any potential sponsor and say, hey, we're running a women's only event or a juniors only event. There's just, you're pulling on some heartstrings, I guess, a little bit more when you know you have that specific demographic you're trying to go after. And so I think just making it very clear that that's who you're doing this for and maybe what your overall goal or agenda is, I think is what will get somebody to be like, yeah, that sounds great. I'd love to support that. Because often they'll follow up with, well, how many juniors do you have? Or how many women do you have? And then maybe they can tailor their donation or their, you know, contribution accordingly. Oh, you're expecting 90 women. Yeah, we could donate 90 blanks, you know, that will cover every single woman. So I think just being very clear and explicit that you're trying to host a specific demographic, I think that alone should help you out. I'm not a huge fundraiser and or sponsorship getter. I feel like that's probably the place I've fallen short most throughout my career. Even all these years later, I still feel awkward sometimes going and asking people to support my events. So usually they just come out of my own pocket, which isn't the smartest move. But One thing I will say as just a general philosophy to that is offer something, or let me rephrase that. Ask a sponsor what they want to get out of it. Kind of flip
That's
it on its head.
That's a great question.
Because Maceman said this years ago, and I've always thought about this. Putting my name on a T-sign means nothing to me right now. It doesn't. Mm-hmm. It doesn't do anything for me as a company or as a person to put my name on a T-sign or on the back of a T-shirt. That's just me. Other people may love that, and that's exactly what they're going for. Ask a sponsor, what kind of recognition would you like? And you'd be surprised how often they have something that's clever or innovative or something that's maybe even bigger than what you thought you'd get out of them, but they feel more fulfilled giving it to you. When they say to you, hey, we'd love to sponsor you. You said you're looking for some shelters. What if I bring four tents that have our logos already on them? Perfect. You just got four canopies and they all happen to say, you know, company ABC on them. That's a win-win. They're putting it out. They're doing the work and putting them up and or using them. Their company is getting the branding that they were looking for. And you just got the four tents that you needed. So flip it. Ask them what they want. Ask them what feels fulfilling. Because asking me for $45 to put my name on a T-sign right now, not only is it kind of old, it's just not fulfilling to me personally. So,
and I like that too, because if you're going out and asking businesses maybe that are not related to disc golf, we're going to get new perspectives. Because like you said, we're stuck in the same old thing. This is how we've been doing it. And so you do get a little bit fresh variety, you know, if you let the sponsor kind of do their own thing or what they want to do.
Yeah. I mean, a grocery store might have very different, you know, reaction. They may say, we can give you, you know,
fruit, leftover fruit.
Yeah. We can give you the fruit, or we can give you, hey, we've got bottled water, or, you know, what if we do this, or what if we, you know, I mean, there's so many different ways that they might reply that you never even thought of. And you're like, oh,
exactly.
Yeah. That would be amazing if you guys gave us that.
Yep. I agree.
So as
companies, they don't care about the T sign, but if they can get a specific kind of coupon or something into the hands of players, because they know that for every, however many coupons they give out, they drum up a certain, you know, amount of business, or
exactly,
for every order of fries they give away, somebody comes in and buys four or five sandwiches too, you know, that kind of thing. And these companies know that about themselves. It's not up to us to solve that for them. It's up to us to just try to present them an opportunity to do whatever they already know works.
Bingo.
I think this also goes back to something you said earlier about how tournament directors, sometimes they have to be talking heads and they have to be good at this kind of sort of sales and this kind of sort of being the face of the organization, which means somebody else maybe working with the TD has to be the one that's good at maybe managing the money or, you know, managing
handling the merchandise,
the tee times and the merchandise and the spreadsheets and all of those kinds of things that go into it. So safety in numbers, right?
Yeah. Terry, you probably don't go around asking for sponsorship because that's a time thing and you don't have any time.
Right.
It's a little bit of that, but I'll admit if I ask for sponsorship now, I have a different perspective that I then personally try to tie in video coverage, because I feel like my quick pitch is you could give me $500 and maybe 90 people at the event see the T sign. Maybe they pay attention to it. Maybe they don't, but they see the T sign. Or you could give me $500 and we're going to film the final round. And I guarantee you, not only will a few thousand minimum see it on video coverage, but also it's there so that when somebody goes and watches this video in 10 years and comes back to replay it, you're still the sponsor of that hole on my broad. So I have a different perspective that I feel like I should be that angle. I should be working even harder, but I feel like it's a little more evergreen and it can play out a lot longer from a video perspective. So that's where, not that I'm looking for a pitch here, but that's where sometimes having a camera crew, you know, whether it's me or someone else, might be actually a bigger, better investment. You might have to pay the camera crew, but if that can help then generate a few thousand extra dollars in terms of other sponsorship, it offsets it, or, you know, you come out ahead a little bit. So there's a lot of different angles and ways to look at it.
That's a really good tie-in to go to your next hat, Terry. So
right, yeah, it's a great segue.
Well, I got to leave and go design a course. There's two courses I'm working on. I don't know if you mean that, but I am working on two different courses. One just down the road that's going to be like 6 or 9 holes, super short, all under 200 feet. I'm excited about that. And then I'm going to work on a bluish, not quite championship level course about an hour from me. Just Dang. To interrupt you briefly, wow. Course design is something I dabble in. I've done about 30 some courses in Wisconsin, and that again has taken a back seat, but I do enjoy it and or helping facilitate it. If I'm not physically out there, I like to bring in a couple people, and then I usually then become the talking head to the parks department to help make the sale on the course, to help, you know, pitch them the concept of having disc golf. And then usually, you know, we work to get it in from there. So, but anyway, no, that's not that, that's a, that's a shallow hat today. What's the next one?
Let's go ahead and touch on that. What is your best advice? Cause we've had a few course designers on here. I enjoy it as well.
Sure.
What would you say your best advice to anyone trying to design a course?
No, first of all, it's a big dog type answer. Instead of provisional, I go with safety.
Yep.
Like, first of all, it has to be safe. There's way too many courses I see, I play, I visit that are just absolutely unsafe and waiting for a lawsuit to happen. So safety is number one, but with safety in mind comes point number two, which is absolutely you have to design for the right clientele or the right purpose.
Yep.
I have literally a couple acres down the road when that's going to get put in for this local course. It's going to be meant for 100 to 150 foot holes for kids to get introduced or new players to get introduced to it. The first complaint or the first review on UDisc is going to be, this course sucks. You know, I couldn't even throw it 200 feet. Well, it's not meant for you.
Exactly.
And so design with the user in mind. And if that's, find out who's making that decision. Is it the parks department? Is it a land concern? Is it, a future plan of big tournaments? Just know who your user base is intended for and design to them accordingly. If you have 80 acres and free reign to do whatever you want, yeah, you probably could have a championship caliber course or two. But if you have 6 acres and there's also a workout path, like you're
playground.
Probably talking a couple holes. Yeah. And you're talking about, 100 foot holes or whatever, a practice zone. So that's my biggest takeaway. It is frustrating and infuriating to see reviews of courses, because I go to a course, safe or otherwise, and I immediately look at it and I think, okay, what was the intention here? What do I feel like was the intention? And then I kind of gauge my, my review or my, rating accordingly. I mean, if you're given 12 acres and it's wide open, I don't expect you, to paint a Picasso here. Like, you did with what you could. And as long as it's safe, I'm okay with it. Cause it might be the only course within a half hour of there.
Right.
So you did with what you had.
Okay, so the hat that I was referring to was your broadcasting, the commentary, all the other things that you do to for this sport. So when did that start? We did the beginning of disc golf for you. Let's and TD.
Really, it started back around like 08, 09, somewhere in that neighborhood. I always say whenever Disc Golf Planet TV was around. I was during the very first broadcast, I was one of about a dozen people that was like, oh, hey, you're here. Sit in that chair and you're going to sit next to Mace, or you're going to sit next to Joe Rotan or Jonathan Poole or Crazy John or
Rebecca
Dave Greenwell, Jim Oates. I think those were most of them. And sit down next to them. You're going to talk for a half hour. We'll see how it goes. And then we're going to swap you out. And that was like literally how the first broadcast went, regardless of how you did.
I mean, it was an audition. Yeah.
Yeah. It was an on air live audition. And it was.
You must have passed.
I guess.
You did well.
I'm flattered that Greenwell and Oates and Crazy have often said, hey, you know, we were the best team. And I'm like, okay, I was just sitting there talking. So thanks. It was fun. Yeah. And so Disc Golf Planet, I volunteered with them, helped them out for as many years as I could. Johnny V and I also kind of helped out. 2010 is technically, in this very room I'm in right now, is when I did my first ever video blog, January of 2010. That was just me, blathering into a camera for 5 minutes. And and then Smashbox started officially in 2014, which is when we were then doing live. I was already doing post-production. Then we started our own live, doing it that way with a bunch of PDGA events. And then we started our podcast at the end of 2014, once that season was coming to a close. So media stuff started around 09, 08, 09, really for myself, whether it was the Disc Golf Guy, in air quotes, or Smashbox. That was respectively 2010 for Disc Golf Guy and 2014 for Smashbox. And then Smashbox ultimately kind of just was engulfed or consumed as part of the Disc Golf Network and the Pro Tour in the last couple of years.
So did you ever go to any kind of schooling for that? Was this ever a passion or a thought?
No.
Were you a broadcaster?
I wish.
Or anything?
No. The terrible irony here is I got a double major in communications and more so in computers. And I worked as an office guy in the Department of Journalism and Mass Communications, but I never took a class. I never took a class, though.
You had a little bit of
knowledge. I made photocopies. I made photocopies for the professors of classes I should have been taking. Right. Is really what it was. When I was in college, I worked a bunch of jobs simultaneously. And one of those was working in the Department of Mass Communications, but I never took any of the classes because I had no idea. I thought my life would be something computer related, and it indirectly is. But no, I never took any broadcasting or film. I wish I would have taken all of those. I took none of them. At some point, I would have learned the voice of Grant, I think.
Yeah,
right, Grant?
I don't know.
You developed that, right? That's not natural. Don't tell me you were gifted with that.
A little bit. I worked in radio. I got a job in radio and had a couple of people there, one in particular who had been in radio for like 30 or 40 years and just kind of helped me understand what parts of speaking into a microphone you need to learn and what parts you need to not be afraid to be natural about it, because otherwise it sounds like you're faking it and people pick up on that kind of nuance. And even if they don't realize they do, they do. And then they say they don't like listening to you for one reason or another, and they can't put their finger on why. And you, so yeah, it was, I think you and I probably learned in much the same way, in that we got into something because we thought it was interesting. We had a passion for the subject matter. And then as we went, we learned from other people, oh, this is how you do a stand-up. Oh, this is how you do a sponsor read. Oh, this is how you do live versus something, you know, that can go back and you can edit after the fact. You know, I only get one take at it, so I'm going to do it this way because it's less likely to have a problem. Oh, I get three or four takes at it. Okay, I'm going to have some fun. I'm going to goof off a little bit and maybe something will work. So I think actually we both have a similar sort of education, and for that matter, Jennifer as well, you know, getting thrown in, and then over time getting some feedback from trusted friends and, you know, that kind of thing, and learning, oh, okay, well, I know now I don't want to do that anymore because other people that are successful don't do that. And so, you know,
I just roll with it. Actually, I just kind of just keep making the mistakes and just keep rolling with it and ask for forgiveness later.
Right. True. Terry, I honestly think this all speaks to a little bit of a running theme with regard to tournament directing, with regard to designing a course. If you get the opportunity, you've got to just kind of go into it and try to get help from people as you go. Right. That's like the thing not to be afraid of, is I have the opportunity. Great. Now I just need to be smart maybe about asking for help from the right people.
Certainly. I mean, I say it all the time. There's a lot of people way smarter than me that you always can go after that have the tools and the resources. And now in 2022, you always have the internet as well. And for as much dumb stuff as that's on the internet, there's plenty of great insight and information out there as well. And maybe my last quick point on that was I started my video blog in 2010 with a $99 camera. Like I said, in this very room, all I knew was I didn't want to write, and blogging was super popular, and I knew I wasn't a writer. And so I read a book by Gary Vaynerchuk, who's now, you know, goes on to be one of the most huge social media influencers and people in the world. But I read his book that basically said, you know, get off your butt and just do it. Make mistakes, quit making excuses, and just do it. I picked up a camera. I was like, I'll talk about the new PDGA video that's about to release, or the new Clash DVD, or the new Katana that I think is all part of my first ever video blog. And from there, I just made a million mistakes. And here we are, 12 years later. So just get started.
How far have we come?
He's down to like 1,000 mistakes.
Just, that's how far you've come. Zero off the end of the number of mistakes that you made. No, really, how far because you were back in the earliest days of post-production, the earliest days of even live, how far have we come?
Oh my gosh.
I mean, people have no idea.
People have no idea. Jen can attest to this because of her start too. Like, we used to have Worlds in July or August, and if the PDGA and everything went right, we maybe got a VHS by Christmas of the Worlds. And that was like the production of the year. Mm-hmm. And now we are putting out videos that are better quality graphics and productions 12 hours later that are streaming to your phones that are better than what were put out in, you know, and that's all technology, clearly.
Oh, for sure.
But it's amazing where we've come, and ordering the world's VHSs or the world's DVDs.
I've got a few of the DVDs. Yeah.
I've got them all because I was, you know, because I'm a hoarder and a collector. So I have all of those things too. And we're light years. People have no idea where we've come. Just like I was saying about the PDGA sending out spreadsheets or sending out a packet of papers when you ran a tournament to now you can run it from your phone. Yeah. Just people have no idea. And I don't want to sound like the old man, hey, get off my lawn, but back in my day, like things.
It's so true.
So
Those old videos, yikes.
I'm honored that I was here from a lot of the earliest stuff. You know, when I think back to the mid-90s and now watching to where we are here in 2022, I'm just honored to have experienced it. And that's kind of synonymous with the internet, right? Like the internet coming out in the mid-90s, and then going everything from dial-up to where we are today and everything in between. We're just fortunate that I watched disc golf grow up in that sense.
Right.
And we're just in another world, and live is going to continue to get better. Post isn't going anywhere. It may or may not be as prevalent, but post-production as a concept isn't going anywhere. I want to throw that out there so everyone knows. I don't think otherwise. I do post-production too. So it's always going to have a fit and a need. And live is going to also continue to get better, and social media is going to get better, and everyone's viewing experience on site or off site is going to get better.
The number of crews that we had out there. I mean, you guys had 1 to 2 cameras, maybe.
Yeah.
You know, now look at how many cameras per hole, how many holes being covered. You know, stationary cameras, like just this
replay,
year.
Dedicated cameras, like Grant was working at Worlds. What the first broadcast people had Johnny V in Milwaukee and me holding a camera, filming with a mic pointed at me
I could call
the action. Me doing the on course microphone, calling it, trying to whisper. I mean, Smashbox covered the first ever AM Worlds live in 2014. And it's because we were cutting our teeth. And I don't even know if we were paid $500 to be there for the week, because live was this crazy concept. And here we are now.
You're on the catch cam. You're filming from the catch cam with a microphone, providing your own like voiceover commentary. Yep. while carrying the equipment or something, carrying the equipment, trying not to breathe into the microphone, whispering, which is so appropriate for golf because he's got about 30 feet to the basket. I think he's got an AVR in his hand. It looks like the wind is. And you're whispering not because you're trying to add drama, because you're genuinely trying not to distract the player.
Yep.
I mean, that's just hysterical. That alone is a picture of how far things have come.
I think it is.
And now we go to an event
that's got 37 people on staff doing what used to be two. But
what
it's so
was
much
more
better.
Entertaining, though, the actual coverage or what we were wearing back in the day? I mean, because when I watched, I put in some of those old, you know, DVDs, and I'm like, holy crap, what were we thinking? So
That was before. I mean, guys, there was a time before Under Armour existed and before dry
short
fit existed.
The cutoff shirt. We could wear sports bras. I did AmWorld in 99 and we have a picture there with Steady Ed at Waterworks, and like half of us had on sports bras.
To be fair, those temps were like 108. And 112 with heat index. I was there. I was at that same AM Worlds with you. It was ridiculous, but
it was a little toasty.
The super heavy golf shirts, the cotton ones with the colors.
So thick.
That were eight sizes too big because that was the style back then. They didn't make women's. So you've got this shirt that would hang down to your knees, and you've got it tucked into your sport shorts. Good look.
Of Juliana Korver's attire was often men's cut in of a polos or whatever, because they're just we weren't focused
visors.
On women's visors,
the massive visors, the humongous ones with the great big billboard across the front.
It was so bad.
And in 20 years, we're going to be looking back at what we're wearing now, right?
Yeah.
I know. We're going to be making fun of us now. There's no doubt.
We're
going
to be back to sports bras and big, thick shirts. It'll all revolve around.
Well,
I'm going to retire if we go back to that.
You know, Terry, the last picture I want to leave people with, you know, because like I said, this is all about introducing people just to you, to the amount of work that goes into doing some of the things that you do while wearing your different hats. What's life on the road like for you? What does a typical month look like for you in the course of having to wear these two or three hats? Because I think people don't realize that is a lot of work for not only you, but a lot of people that do some of the things that you do. The Disc Golf Network, the camera crews, the broadcast teams. I think a lot more goes into some of that than people give credit, especially when you couple in traveling and, you know, planes and airports and hotels. You know, what does a typical month or a couple of months stretch look like for you?
Yeah, it has gotten so intense lately, and I just can't find myself backing off. And the problem is there's, you know, 52 weekends in a year, and I'm getting closer and closer every year to filling them all. And at some point I genuinely need to back off, because I think Disc Golf Network was live for 30 plus weekends this year. And when we say weekend, but that might be a Friday, Saturday. Yeah. That's a Friday, Saturday, Sunday tournament. That could mean getting there as early as Wednesday to have a press conference on Thursday, to then be live Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And depending if you're close enough, can you either drive home, or are you spending the night into Monday and then maybe taking a half or a whole day to get home on Monday, all to turn around again and leave on Wednesday. So unfortunately, most tournaments from a realistic perspective for me are like a 5-day commitment in, you know, for the 3-day tournament. And now post-production events can be a little bit different. Sometimes you can get in a little later and out a little quicker. Those are definitely secondary in my career right now. But I was just looking. On one hotel app alone that I'm usually most consistent with, because I'm a baller on a budget and I go cheap, I've got 172 nights on one hotel app this year.
Gosh. In 2022?
In 2022. And I reached their status at 40. Yeah, thanks. I'm four times their status. But that's just one app. And then there's two or three that I occasionally use as backups. But that's a lot of nights gone. You know, I say it all the time. It's really my family that takes the brunt of the, you know, sacrifice for me. I'm fortunate that I love the heck out of what I do. So that makes it easier. You're not, you know, I'm not always pulling my teeth to come to the events, but, and I love it. It's so fulfilling and gratifying, but that it also does mean a lot of time away. And I've got, you know, an 11-year-old, a 14-year-old now, girls. And that's meant I've missed birthdays. I've missed, you know, performances. I've missed concerts. And, you know, that definitely wears on me. But that's also been part of, you know, my overall journey and process. And my big takeaway, as selfish as it may be to justify a little bit, is I hope also I'm instilling in my children that they should follow their passion. They should work hard. And sometimes that's going to come with some other sacrifices, but I want them to be proud of things that I've done or things that I'll have hopefully accomplish. And I know that a lot of parents will say, well, I didn't miss my daughter's gymnastics in 9 straight years. I won't have that to claim, but I also hope that when my kids reflect back on my career and what I did as a dad, they can say, well, my dad wasn't here for everything, but here's some of the big things that he accomplished, or here's how he helped move things forward. And I hope that in a way will make them proud just the same. So
I feel you 100%. And that's what I was actually talking to Grant prior to this was, you know, back in the day, you and I could do the stuff during the week at home and you just went to the golf tournament on the weekend. It was maybe a 2-day deal. And there was all this other time that you could do other things, and that's gone. I mean, you guys, the TV crew, you know, production and all of that, you guys probably get less sleep than we do as players. And I know it's exhausting for us. And so the amount of hours that you guys have to put in to these events it's unreal. And now I see a little bit more of that with helping, you know, the PDGA and doing Ace Run Pro and things like that. It is unreal the amount of time that it takes. And this is, you know, like you said, every tournament's usually 5 days. You know, there's no
some
more.
Some of them are 6 or more.
Yeah. There's easy. No more working, you know, healthcare and golfing. I have to choose. What do I want to do right now? And, you know, you and I both having kids back home, like, it's not just what do we want to do. You have to put in all of that. And it's very hard. And talk about pulling on heartstrings. You know,
it got all deep and dusty in here for a minute.
It's
there.
A huge, you know, sacrifice that we make out there. But like you said, hopefully we, you know, are at least showing our kids that we can achieve and do things, you know, if you put your mind to it and you dedicate yourself and fully commit to things. But it's definitely hard to be away from family.
It is. And maybe my big full circle takeaway will be that I feel like one or both of my daughters at some point will be official employees and or, you know, doing something in media, photography, yeah, media, video, interviews. They're both developing a camera presence of their own. And well, so that might be the ultimate.
Their life has been surrounded by it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. We're in a very different world now as kids are more comfortable with it. But I feel like that might be a little bit of a payoff of sorts as well, that, you know, if they're comfortable in front of cameras and they find themselves in a career, whether it's disc golf related or whatever, I think that is also a pretty big takeaway that I'm happy with.
Yeah. I hope that one day I will be the caddy and my kids will be on tour. And that's my dream.
Well, and we'll be talking about the good old days together on a podcast.
That's right. Well, Terry and I will still be here 20 years down the road with our walkers.
You got it.
Beautiful. It takes a lot. It takes a lot for disc golf to be a part of our lives. It takes a lot for those that are listening to this podcast right now to get to enjoy more disc golf on YouTube, on the Disc Golf Network. It takes a lot for them to have events to play in during the course of their daily lives, wherever you're listening from. And Terry, you do a lot in all of those realms to make it happen. So thanks for telling us a little bit about what life's like for you, for pulling the curtain back a little bit. I'm sure a lot of people can learn something from some of your experiences, whether they want to go into directing events or whether they want to go into disc golf media, whether they just want to enjoy the sport a little bit deeper. So, hey, thanks for the time. Thanks for pulling the curtain back. We appreciate it.
Yeah, guys, thank you. I from day one when I saw that PDGA was going to be running with a podcast again, obviously you guys have proven, just like all the other podcasts, like find whatever it is, whatever your angle, your take, your niche, your combo, structured, unstructured, you know, friends, family, whoever it is, those are all opportunities. And everybody should know I'm a huge PDGA supporter and fan, and all the work you guys are doing. Thanks for being out there and putting yourselves out there week in and week out as well. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Terry.
All right.
Terry Thank you guys. Miller, See everyone. He's got stuff to do. Well, one more time, thanks again to Terry, the Disc Golf Guy Miller, for taking some time out of his schedule to be with us today.
Yeah, it was so great flipping the roles on Terry and putting him as the one to be interviewed. So thank you, Terry, for joining us on PDGA Radio.
I still think we should have made him ask himself his own questions.
Don't you?
Absolutely.
Back later on this month with another episode. See ya.
Bye.